Your Bible, Acts chapter 15. And while you're making your way over to that place, let me just echo what's already been said. Had great crowds. I'm so encouraged by that. I appreciate that. It's a very, very narrow study of some principles from God's Word to help us with a specific part of our life. And I know y'all been told a lot about that for the last few weeks. And I appreciate the spirit that's driving you to be here, to be part of this. One of the things we've tried to say over and over again is that it's our intent to field your questions. And so I'm going to pause periodically and ask if anybody has a question. If the ladies want to write one down, Tim is in the back. He's ready to collect those, and we'll field those as we go through, and then I'll save some time at the end to do that. Let me tell you why that's important to me. That helps us direct the teaching for you and for the things that you need. And so we really are eager to hear your feedback or to answer the questions you have. We're not just doing that out of routine, but it's important so that this study can be as directed as narrowly as possible to the things that you're wrestling with or the things you'd like to know about. So keep that in mind as we go through the night tonight. Jot those questions down. Be ready to pose them. I will try to pause periodically and talk about that. So I want to begin in Acts chapter 15 because I think we find recorded here a crucial conversation. Before we start analyzing that, do you remember the three parts of a crucial conversation? Y'all can kind of mutter them so I know that you actually do. Yeah. Okay. So stakes are high and opinions vary and emotions run strong. Good. So you remembered what we talked about last night. We defined this animal that we're trying to tame, these crucial conversations. And one of the things I said last night is that they're going on all the time. And if they are going all the time, we should expect to find that in the Bible, right? And the truth is, we do find all kinds of crucial conversations. Conversations that would fit this definition are found throughout the Bible story. Acts 15 is one of my favorite examples. And so, what we're going to do tonight is not so much study Acts 15. You're good Bible students. You've been through Acts before. You've talked about this chapter. I want to do something a little different tonight. I want us to analyze this crucial conversation together because I think there's a lot that we can learn from it. So just a couple of questions about Acts 15. First of all, let's talk about what's going on. Acts 15 is another chapter in the ongoing story of this Gentile problem for the early disciples. If you are a student of Acts, you know it's not the first time we encounter this. Just go back a little bit to Acts 10 and 11. And when Peter goes to Cornelius, that is not an idea enthusiastically embraced by all the other disciples. He gets called in on the carpet about that in Acts 11. And there's some folks want to know, what were you doing going to the Gentiles? It is perhaps the greatest theological controversy among early disciples. Two whole books of the New Testament really speak to this issue of Gentiles and what we're going to do with them. And so here in Acts 15, we're encountering that problem again, okay? Some guys have come and they've started messing with Paul and his work. Some folks from the Pharisees are connected formally with the Pharisees are coming in and they're trying to press this agenda that Gentile converts sort of had to become Jews in order to be Christians. I know it's weird math, but that's what was kind of going on at the time. And so when we get to Acts 15, there's been a confrontation about that, and a decision is made. We need to go to Jerusalem. The apostles need to get together, and there needs to be a conversation about this problem. So my question to you would be, if you're imagining what that conversation is going to look like, do you think it would fit our definition? Would it be a crucial conversation? What do you think? Y'all can respond, like shaking your head up and down. Yeah, with me? It's controversial, to be sure. Opinions vary. These guys from the Pharisees do not agree with Paul and Barnabas about this issue. So it's a controversial issue. Do you think it's an emotional issue? I think it's pretty clear that this crowd from the Pharisees is very upset about what Paul is doing, just like there were people very upset with Peter in Acts chapter 11. So on that side, things are very emotional. But listen, I think Paul's pretty worked up about this too. Paul is all in and invested in this work. And these guys are coming and they are messing with his work. And by the way, Paul is right about this, okay? And he knows he's right about this. So he's kind of worked up too. Are the stakes high here? We're talking about, this is me and you, folks. The future of Gentile converts. This is a huge issue that they're wrestling with. So when you go back to our definition, this is exactly what a crucial conversation is. Now, I'll do something weird. We're not really going to talk about ins and outs of everything that's said in this big discussion. I want to jump to the end and pose this question and ask you, was it a failed conversation? No, it wasn't. Even though this thing was high stakes, very emotional, very divided opinion, there's this bizarre thing that happens. Look down at verse 22. This is Acts 15, 22. Then it seemed good to the apostles and the elders and the whole church to choose men from among them to send to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. So whatever it is they're setting out to do here, everybody was on board with a plan of action, right? What's more interesting is you get down to verse 25 and it says this. It seemed good to us, having become of one mind. Think about that. All these parties have come together. They've had this conversation, this high stakes, controversial, emotional issue. And they all came to be of one mind about it and agree on a plan going forward to address the issue. It was the epitome of how we want a crucial conversation to go. And so the first thing that I want to say to you is I have biblical proof that we can do this better. I told you that one of our biggest challenges when we talk about this is dealing with the skeptic, the person that has been in so many failed conversations that they listen to all of this and they say, listen, I don't know who that's working for, but it doesn't work at my house. Or it's not going to work on my job with the people that I have to work with. Or it won't work in this church. Not with these elders or with these people that the elders have to deal with. We convince ourselves that we only have what the book calls the fool's choice. I've only got two bad options. Either I speak my mind and this goes badly, or I sit and suffer in silence. We've been trying to repudiate that myth this weekend and to say there is a better way. And so looking back to Acts 15, the question we have to answer is, well, how did they do this? What was it that is going on here that enabled them to take this really tough controversy and end up with a good conclusion? So in the other book that I mentioned to you last night, Crucial Conversations, they say that there is one thing, they call it in the book, the thing that is absolutely essential in managing crucial conversations well. And I will tell you why I mentioned that to you in this book. The one thing they talk about in this book is exactly what they were doing in Acts 15. I just want to illustrate that they've been ripping off God all along, okay? God thought about this stuff way before they did. And we see the one thing that they say is so important at work right here in Acts 15. So, what is the one thing? Here's what I want you to notice about this conversation in Acts chapter 15. I want you to notice with me that all of the parties who have a stake in this issue were brought together and allowed to share all of the relevant information that needed to be shared about this issue. That's a fancy bookish way of saying they got everybody together and they all talked about this. And everybody got to put their stuff on the table. In fact, that's the interesting thing about Acts 15. Acts 15 is very deliberate in telling us that everybody got to take part in this conversation. So I'm going to work back through this text. I would point you, first of all, to verse 5, where we hear this crowd from the Pharisees making their points about the Gentiles. We know they're speaking because it says that they're speaking and they're making their case. But they're not the only ones talking, because then we're told in verse 6 that the apostles and the elders, they come together and they're going to talk about this issue. And then in verse number 7, it says there was great debate about that. So when they say it was a debate, what does that tell you? Who's being heard? Everybody. Both sides of this issue are being heard. Of necessity, debate requires that the opposing points of view are getting to make their case. In fact, in verse number 7, we know that Peter got to say something, because we're told some about that. And then verse number 12, Paul and Barnabas get to say something. And then in verse number 13, James also gets to weigh in on this. Here's my point. All the way through this, everybody with a stake in this issue is getting to be part of this gathering and to share the information that they had that was important. The guys who wrote this book, when they go out and they research effective communicators, did years and years of study, you know what they say effective communicators do? They get all the relevant people to add all the relevant information to the discussion. In fact, let me quote from their book. This is what they say. At the core of every successful conversation lies the free flow of relevant information. People openly and honestly express their opinions, share their feelings, and articulate their theories. They willingly and capably share their views, even when their views are controversial and unpopular. Plug in Acts 15, verse 5, when this group from the Pharisees gets to speak. It's the one thing extremely effective communicators we studied were routinely able to achieve. You see it? What's happening in Acts 15 is exactly what the authors of the book say is the one key thing we have to do to help crucial conversations work out well. In fact, they have a name for it. They call this key thing dialogue. And I think there's a blank on your sheet to write that down. So would you do that with me? So I've given you two pieces tonight. I just explained that the book says the key thing to making crucial conversations work well is dialogue. And before that, we looked at an example in the Bible where dialogue was the very thing that helped those people in Acts 15 work out this thorny problem that was in front of them. When we talk about dialogue, we just mean the free flow of all relevant information from all the relevant parties. Everybody gets to sit down and be part of the discussion and put their thinking on the table. Would you write that down? Because frankly, this little book I mentioned to you last night, I think it's in chapter 2, where they say dialogue is the one thing. You want to guess what they do with the rest of the book? Explain to you how to get people to talk. How you create dialogue. How you keep people in dialogue. That's what the whole book is about. That's what they mean when they say it is the one thing. Now, I've given you the example from Acts. I've referenced this book and the position they take on it. What I'd like to do thirdly, since I think this is really, really critical, is use an illustration that I hope will help you carry this away in your memory, okay? So to explain what we're talking about, I want you to imagine this, that everybody comes to a conversation with a bucket. Everybody enters a crucial conversation with a bucket. Doesn't matter who the players are. If you are an elder meeting with parents unhappy with something that happens in the Bible class, everybody's coming in with a bucket. If you're a husband and wife sitting down to have a conversation about the holidays, both of you bring a bucket. You know what's in the bucket? Well, your thoughts, your opinions, your feelings, your theories, everything that you have that's relevant to this subject that you're going to be talking about. You bring all of this in your bucket. So when the elders are going to sit down and talk to parents about a problem in the Bible class, the elders have some thoughts about that. right? And when you're going to sit down and talk to your wife about the holidays and where you're going to spend them, you've got some thoughts about that, right? But guess what? So does she. She's got a bucket too, and there's some stuff in it. And when you sit down for a meeting with the elders, you've got some stuff, but they've got some stuff too. Everybody brings a bucket to the conversation. So go back to Acts 15. Do you see it there? This group from the Pharisees that's causing all the problem, they've got some thoughts about all this, right? But so did Paul and Barnabas. They had some things to share too. Here's the other thing you need to know about what's in the bucket. We don't all have the same stuff in our bucket. So think back to Acts chapter 15, right? What Paul and Barnabas had to share, it wasn't the same thing this group from among the Pharisees had to share. In fact, one of the great things about Peter and Paul and Barnabas and James, even those guys all agree with each other, one of the great things about Acts 15 is they all come at this from different angles. They say different things. They had different information that they had to share. We all bring a bucket to the conversation. We've all got stuff in it we need to share, and it isn't the same stuff. Some of the stuff is even wrong. It's wrong information. This group from the Pharisees, the stuff in their bucket, some of it isn't even right. It isn't God's will, and yet they have it. And they need to share it. Which brings me to the next thing I need to say. All this stuff's in our buckets. What are we going to do with it? Yeah. All this stuff in the bucket is going to have to be dumped out in what the authors of this book call the pool of meaning. You could just think of it as a big old cow feeding tub, or a cow watering tub. Is there a name for that, babe? My wife grew up in a farm. She would know what that is. It's that big metal thing where they water cows. Okay, just imagine that. Everybody's going to come along and dump in their bucket. That's what we need to happen here. We need everybody to get their feelings dumped in there and their thoughts dumped in there. We need that pool to be really, really deep, filled with lots of different ideas. Everyone needs a chance to weigh in. And look at Acts 15. That is exactly what's happening. All these people who had a stake in this have an opportunity to dump their bucket in, talk about how they feel about this, how they see this, what their theories are. And all of that is brought together in this great discussion they have in Jerusalem. The authors of the book say that is the one thing critical to crucial conversations turning out well. Now, all we may have accomplished up to this point is raising all kinds of questions that we now need to come back and answer. Maybe you're sitting there thinking, so I don't understand why that's the one thing. Why is that so important? And why do we want everybody adding their information to a conversation? Because some of the information is wrong. Would it be better just to leave that out? And frankly, in Acts 15, there were apostles there. Why do we even need the Pharisees, this group from the Pharisees, to be speaking? Why not just have the apostles, inspired by the Spirit, stand up, issue an edict, and be done with this? Sometimes we want the elders to do the same thing. We don't need to be talking about this. Let's be efficient. Let's get a decision made. Get someone with authority and in charge just to issue a ruling, announce it to everybody, and we don't have to waste all this time with buckets and pools and dumping stuff in, right? So, we got a lot more ground to cover tonight. We've said dialogue is the one thing. I need to talk to you about why it's the one thing and why it's so vital to crucial conversations working out well. So let's talk about that a little bit. I got some things I want you to write down. Three things that will explain why dialogue is the one thing. Number one, it's the one thing because it increases understanding. Would you write that down, please? Dialogue is critical because as everyone dumps in their information, it increases understanding. Now, I'm going to speculate a little bit about Acts 15. Will you let me do that? I say it's speculation because it's not actually stated in the text, but it's my suspicion about some things that are going on here that actually work toward this good conclusion. I'm thinking that some of these guys who were from the Pharisees, I'm thinking that some of them had no idea what had happened with Paul in the Gentile world. I especially think that some of them had no idea about how God had worked and these miraculous things had been done through Paul and Barnabas and the other traveling companions as they're doing this work among the Gentiles. And so I'm thinking as Paul is dumping in his bucket, as he's sharing this information at this meeting, I think some of these people are getting new information, don't you? I think some of them are hearing things they have never heard before. Their understanding is growing. Do you see that? And I don't think they were the only ones hearing things. I've wondered about even Paul. You know, where has Paul been? He was not home-based in Jerusalem, surrounded by these guys and hearing their theories being advanced all the time. He's been off working in the Gentile world. And I just wonder, I'm not trying to suggest that he'd never heard of these guys or confronted these things before, but I think as they're making their case, Paul may well have been hearing things, understanding things that he did not appreciate or at least understand the depth of until he began to hear these guys speak. And so listening to them weigh in was really valuable. He's understanding his opponents better. Is there value in that? Even if they're wrong, it helps to understand where they are. And so everybody getting to weigh in increases understanding. I will tell you that that doesn't just apply to the situation in Acts 15. It applies in your life and my life too. Can I illustrate that for you? So my son comes home from school. This is in the spring of his senior year. And he says to me, I got an F on my research paper because I didn't staple the final copy and the rough draft together. I expect you, John, to react a little more to that because I know when he said that to me, I did. I said, wait, say that again. You got an F. She failed you because you didn't staple two things together? He said, yeah, that's right. I said, son, that can't be true. And he said, well, I don't know what to tell you, Dad. She failed me because I didn't staple this thing together. So you know what I did, right? What does any good parent do? I called the teacher. We needed someone else to dump their bucket in. You with me? So I called the teacher. I said, I need to come by and talk to you. She said, great. Come on by. That should have been a clue. I went and sat out in her class. I tried not to have the face that would give away that I was upset. And I just said, oh, you know, Todd came home yesterday and he said that you failed him on this research paper because he didn't staple the rough draft together. And she said, that's not entirely true. And so she began. She had a list. I think she had rehearsed the speech because it was delivered with excellence. She said, well, first he didn't do this and I didn't count off for that. And then he didn't do that and I didn't count off for that. She went through like 12 things. And I'm just sort of slipping under the seat wanting to crawl out and hide by the time she got to item number 12. And she said, frankly, Mr. Manning, by the time I got to the not stapling the thing together, I just thought I'd cut him enough breaks. And I looked at her and said, I think you're right. I need to go have another crucial conversation with someone else. So letting her add to the pool of meaning, letting her dump in her bucket, supplied me with information that I didn't have, which totally reframed the situation. So I want to make a point here that I think is really, really important. I think a lot of our problems with one another in the church family are a lot about misunderstandings. It's where we've drawn conclusions without having all the information. And if we would take the time to go sit down with someone and dump in our bucket and then listen while they dump in their bucket, I think about 90% of the things that we get cross purposes about could be eliminated pretty quickly. Which, by the way, it's interesting that Jesus said in Matthew 18 and verse 15, if you have something against your brother, what are you supposed to do? Oh, what a novel idea. Go to him. Pour out your bucket. Let him pour in his bucket. And you know, it's amazing how when two people talk to each other and get it all out on the table, the vast majority of the time, what we find out is, oh, I just misunderstood that. Like my wife and I at the hotel 2 days ago. Well, I thought you were mad at me. No, my brain's just working on something else. So dialogue increases understanding. That's why it's the one thing. Secondly, let's add to this list because we're not finished. It also leads to better decision making. And I think we also see that in Acts chapter 15. Imagine that the only people who were heard in that gathering was this group from the Pharisees. They were the only people who got to speak at all. How do you think that would have turned out? Probably not so good. If that's the only information they had, they probably would have made the wrong decision. Having these other men speak and add what they knew to the equation, I think helped this thing work out in the way that it was supposed to. Remember that everybody brings a bucket, but we don't have the same information in our bucket. And so as each one adds, there's more and more information being supplied that helps us make a better decision. So we see that in Acts 15. Let me give you another illustration. Several years ago, some of our deacons convinced us that we could get more people into our auditorium if we got rid of the pews and we swapped them out for theater seats, which I didn't care about at all because I never sit in the seats. I'm always preaching. But they decided that was a really good thing to do, to switch out the pews and add theater seats. And we would, well, see, you guys all spread out when you sit in the pew, and our seats make you sit close together. And the thought was, we can sit more people that way. Interesting theory. I'm not sure it's true, but that was their theory. So we decided we ought to look into that idea. But we needed some people to weigh in on that. For example, the company that was going to do this sent us a sample. It was like two of these seats set side by side. And we brought them in the building, and one of the things we did is we said, we need a couple of our young moms to come and try these out because we were afraid they would eat their children. And so the moms came and they sat in them and said, well, you know, the tension's going to have to be tighter so they don't slam as quickly and eat our children, which was good counsel. We had some other brethren who needed to have more space to accommodate them. Is that as gentle a way to say that as I can? And they were concerned about having to squeeze into a little seat. We thought, oh, we didn't think about that. That's probably a good point. So we talked to the seating company and they said, well, yeah, you know, actually they come in different widths. And so you could order different widths and that can be worked into your plan. And so we had about a half dozen conversations like that. Someone pointed out that that if you go to these theater-style seats, he's got his stuff laying next to him here. Y'all realize that with theater seats, there's no place to put your stuff. And some smart person came along and said, where are you going to put the songbooks? We thought, wow, that's a really good question. And so we had to have another company come in and put some kind of racks on the back so we would have room for our songbooks. You see, the more people we let participate and help us, the more things we began to think about that we had never thought about before. And when we finally got it done, well, you know, everybody pretty much bought into that decision because it made sense to them. They got to add information that helped us make a better decision about all of it. You see what I'm saying? So my point about that is that when we get more feedback, more information, we make better decisions. Some people will contend that gathering all that feedback is such a time waster, okay? I am not convinced that that's true. So let me give you another illustration from our church family. We have this system, we got it after one of the hurricanes, that allows us to call and send a recorded message to everybody in the church. It's awesome. So at that time, services were messed up schedule-wise because of the flooding and the storm and electricity and all that kind of stuff. And so we could send out a call and we'd call everybody and say, we're going to meet one time at 10 o'clock this Sunday. It was a great system. Absolutely. We still have it. It's absolutely great. But people started thinking of a lot of ways to use that. Even in some ways that we thought, that might not be the best use of the Lord's money. And so we had one weekend where someone used it and made a call about this big party they were having. And yeah, it was just awkward and inappropriate. And the elders got some fussing about that. And so we met together to make a decision about the one call system. And so the guys in the room said, well, listen, this is easy. It can only be used for spiritual purposes. Now, you need to understand, none of the elders use this system. But we sat in a room and made a decision about it. Brilliant, right? Listen, not even elders get it right every time, okay? So the morning we made the announcement, hey, folks, the one call thing, only going to be used for spiritual purposes. One of my good buddies came up to me and said, hey, tell me something. Devos. Do Devos for kids on Sunday night? It is spiritual, but it isn't just spiritual. You know, we also kind of do some eating and some games after that's over at people's houses. Do we get to announce that? And I knew. I thought, oh, dude, I'm in trouble. And they thought like three or four more things. And I realized, man, that was dumb. We shouldn't have been making the call about this. We should have been talking to people about it. Folks, we made a lousy decision. And so guess what? We'd have another meeting about one call and another discussion, this time a little smarter, where we actually considered the input from the people that actually used it. So this idea that you're wasting time where you try to get the relevant parties to participate, I'm not sure that's true. Because then you got to go back and look at how many bad decisions we make when we don't do that. And then we have to keep going back and revisiting and revisiting and revisiting. I don't know that's a better plan, folks. So when we let everybody dump in their bucket, we make better decisions. And then finally, dialogue creates buy-in. So looking back at Acts chapter 15, I want you to imagine that at that gathering, they only let Paul speak. And nobody else got to say anything. Would they have made the right decision? Yeah, Paul was right about this issue. How do you think the party from the Pharisees would have felt if they had been shut out and not even allowed to express themselves? Or people loyal to them? You see it? We weren't even allowed to speak. We weren't even heard. See the problem? Had they been shut out and not allowed to participate, it's very doubtful that they would have bought into the decision in the end, that they would have been able to become of one mind. I think one of the benefits of dialogues is it really helps create buy-in when you make a decision, because everybody got to be part of the process. Now, I want to be clear about something. I'm not talking about some kind of gimmick here where you make people feel like you're part of the process. It's like when parents decide where we're going to go on vacation, and we want to feel like kids to feel like they were part of the process. So we invite them in and let them talk, and then we tell them where we're going. I mean, how do you feel about that? How do you feel when your boss does that to you? Pretends he really wants you to know what you think when he's already decided. It's an insult, right? We got to really care about the other side. I've got to believe that other people have in their buckets information that I need. And it's only after I hear that we're going to be able to make a good decision that everybody will agree with. So the pursuit of dialogue is driven by the greatest of motives, the belief that other people have information I need, and I need them to weigh into this conversation. So, dialogue, it's the thing. And as I said, the book from this point on is just devoted to creating dialogue. So what I want to do is stop for a minute and say, does anyone want to make a comment in addition to what I've said or ask a question about what's been said up to this point? And that's not code for don't talk right now. Legitimately, got a couple other things I'm going to say, but I want to give you a chance to weigh in. Steve? The difference would be in the consensus. So one of the chapters that I'm not going to cover is on how you make decisions. And there's actually a whole list of ways to make decisions. There's a time where majority voting on something is a perfectly appropriate thing to do. When nobody cares. Where are we going to go for pie after? Well, maybe y'all do care about that. Where are we going to go get pie after services? And I mean, maybe that's like a 2 on the scale of importance, right? So everybody take a vote. I don't care. Pie is good wherever you get it, right? But if it's over changing the time of services, which means I can't go, then it becomes a very big deal. So a vote in that case would be a bad thing. Another type of decision making they talk about is consensus. And I think it's probably where you're getting to, where everybody's got to come together and we got to be like in Acts 15 of one mind about this. It's a lot harder. And it takes a lot more work and feedback and people being open and listening to pull everybody together on that. It's the hardest kind of decision, but in the end, it winds up being the best kind. It needs to be saved for stuff that matters. I don't know if that answered your question, but I said some things about it. You got something back there? The idea is where people support the decision. So Acts 15:25, they became of one mind about this issue and how they were going to deal with it. They agreed together to do it. The thing about buy-in is that by the time you've heard from everybody, by the time you've added all this new information, you may not be in the same place you were when you started. So your thoughts may shift a little bit as you gain more information. I would go back to our theater seating issue. We didn't wind up with what we thought we were going to do in the beginning. As everybody weighed in, we did switch out seats, but they weren't quite the same as what we ended up with as everybody weighed in and we decide what would be best for our church family. What you want is to make a decision that ultimately all the parties can enthusiastically support, which is the purpose of dialogue. Let's talk it through. I'll say more about this tomorrow. I'm trying not to get ahead of myself. We're going to talk it through and come together about the decision we all believe is the right one. Now, does that make sense? Does that help a little bit? Yep. Anybody else? Okay. So if dialogue is the thing, the one thing critical to helping this thing turn out well, let's talk about the enemies. And so before we wrap up tonight, I'm going to give you the two primary enemies of dialogue. So the first thing I want you to write down is this. Enemy number one is silence. Some people, when conversations turn crucial, refuse to pour in their bucket. They go to silence. They withhold the information that they have to share. Have y'all ever seen that happen? So I've been in counseling sessions with a husband and wife, and we begin to get into some very sensitive territory, and the wife will just shut down. She'll just stop talking. Or I've been in a counseling session where the husband began to get a little heat about his conduct, and he would do one of these. And he'd stop talking. He would go to silence. What he would do is he would withhold his information from the conversation. Now, tell me, why would somebody choose to do that? Why would someone choose to withhold their information? What do you think? Yeah, it's okay. Some people do it out of a sense of frustration. I'm not going to say anything because what I say never makes any difference, so it's not going to do any good. What else? Yeah, the fear that they might be wrong. Yes, what else? How about just afraid? Afraid that I launch out there, if I say what I'm going to say, I'm going to get beaten up about this. People will be unkind to me. Happens a lot in marriage. Crucial conversations go badly so much of the time, and I just get beat up every time, that what people do is they shut down and they say, I'm just not going to say anything. By the way, why do we need to know why people go silent? Why do we need to know why they do it? Yeah, we got to do something about it. It's exactly right. So when somebody has opted out, they're not adding their information. And so we got to do something to try to get them back in, get them back into the conversation. Now, I got to tell you, it's right at this point that some people make a terrible mistake. Some people in crucial conversation, when the other party stops talking, they don't see that as a problem to be fixed. They see it as an advantage to be seized. So imagine the husband and wife. Husband's decided they critically need a new boat. And the wife is the money manager, and she's saying, dude, you need to look at the spreadsheet. We cannot afford a new boat. And so they fight day after day after day. He keeps pleading his case. She keeps holding up the spreadsheet. We can't afford it, can't afford it, can't afford it. Finally, after about 7 days, the wife just gives up, says, whatever, I'm done with this. And she stops talking. And the husband assumes, what? I could get the boat, right? I know, ladies, you're laughing, but sometimes that really is how our minds work. And so he goes out and he buys the boat and he's got this beautiful new shiny boat sitting on the garage. How's that going to work out for him? I tell you what he's done is he's purchased a monument that his wife will see every day that reminds her he doesn't care how I feel. Well, that's a brilliant idea, right? But that's what some people believe. When the other person goes silent, that's an advantage for me. So I can bulldoze now through and get my way about it. By the way, coming back to the issue of buy-in, when the boat breaks or when they're out of money before they're out of bills next month, what do you think is going to happen then? Oh, she's going to remember the boat. And when they're trying to figure out the spreadsheet, she's going to say, I told you we couldn't afford to do this. Do you see what I'm saying? When we bulldoze people, what we're doing is we're ensuring that we will not have the benefit of their information. The pool will be too shallow. I will not have all the facts that I need, especially in this situation. He definitely needed to hear the information his wife was supplying about what was on the spreadsheet. There will not be buy-in, and if the decision goes wrong, well, she won't be silent anymore, will she? So silence is a problem sometimes in crucial conversations. And the thing that we have to do when someone goes to silent is we've got to figure out how to get them back in and not run over them because they've stopped talking. Okay? First problem with, or first enemy rather, of dialogue. Second enemy of dialogue is violence. Some people go silent and withhold their meeting. Other people turn to violence. What a great example of that, look at the end of Acts chapter 7. You know what happens at the end of Acts chapter 7? It's the conclusion of whose story? Stephen's. Yeah. What do they do to Stephen at the end of Acts 7? Yeah, they stone him. So I'm not really talking about killing people when conversations go bad. That's not my point. But there's something interesting that's said in verse 57. Are you there in the Bible? At Acts 7 and verse 57. There's something interesting that's said about the enemies of Stephen. Do you know what they do in verse 57? The text says they covered their ears. And then they rush on him and they murder him. Why do they cover their ears? Because they don't want to hear what he has to say. So I'm not really talking about the kind of violence where people die. But I did want you to look at Stephen's story because I think the root problem is the same. Some people resort to violence because they want to keep other people from adding their information to the pool of meaning. They don't want these other people to have an opportunity to weigh in on this. They want to be the only one who has a chance to address this issue. So let's think about that for a minute. Why would anyone want to prevent someone else from adding to a conversation that's relevant to them? Why would they do that? Why would I only want the pool full of my information so it goes my way? So let's think a little more deeply about that. Why would I want to get my way? Selfishness is so my first impulse on this. To say the other guy is just selfish and self-willed and has to have his way. I often think there's something deeper than that. I think people are afraid. I think people are afraid of what happens if they don't get their way. Now, sometimes I think that's just about selfishness. I like to have my way, and if I don't get it, then I'll be disappointed. But sometimes, especially in a spiritual setting, there are deeper fears there than just not having it my way. An elder, for example, may be concerned about someone being able to weigh in and add their information because they may think their information is wrong. And if these people get to talk and have their way, it's going to lead this church astray and we're going to have problems or whatever, right? Or imagine a father talking to his teenage daughter about that awful boyfriend she brought home. I mean, he doesn't want to sit there listening to her go on and on about his virtues. We know this guy's a loser. And we don't want that other good stuff that she has to say about it. We don't want that to be part of us at all because we're terrified that she might, oh, listen, we can envision her ending up married to this guy and the awful things that'll happen as a consequence of that. It's fear. And the reason I challenge you to think about what would motivate someone to resort to violence, to exclude other people from the conversation, is because when we know what's really down there, I think it changes the way we respond. When we know it's not someone just being selfish and ornery, but in fact they're afraid, then I think it totally alters the way that we try to reach that person. Now, with that on the table, I need to talk a little bit about what we mean when we say violence, because I don't literally mean throwing rocks at people, okay? So when we say people resort to violence, what kind of tactics are we talking about? First of all, some people just raise their voice. Have y'all noticed how there's a cut of humanity that if you just turn up the volume like 4 decibels real quick, there are a group of people that absolutely just shut down. They stop talking. Have y'all noticed that? So sometimes just getting loud. We are going to see my family this Christmas. There are some people that absolutely shut down and just say, okay, whatever. So we talk about violence, we're talking about behaviors that shut down other people and discourage their participations. Some people get loud. Some people just use an intimidating tone. They get kind of harsh. Ever have someone just kind of growl at you like they're trying to intimidate you? Some people interrupt. It's like a lawyer who's watching a witness being questioned by the other attorney, and this all this bad information that's hurting his case is getting out there, and the jury's hearing it. You know what that lawyer does to try to stop that? He objects. And not once. He'll object again and again and again. And he'll do it even he knows the judge is going to overrule him. He just keeps on objecting because he's trying to break up the stride of the other attorney. Have you noticed people doing that to you? Sometimes I'm trying to talk to someone about something crucial. And they interrupt. And then I try to get back in and they interrupt again. It's a technique to try to avoid or prevent other people from weighing in on the subject. Some people just use harsh, extreme overstatements. Well, if you buy that dress, we'll be on the street next month. Right? Other people monologue. Do y'all know what monologuing is? You know what I mean when I say that? I've been involved in crucial conversations with someone who I promise you wasn't breathing. They just kept talking, never paused to take a breath. And they would go on and on and on, like 20, 30, and 40 minutes. And finally, I would just want to surrender so they would stop. Fine, do it your way. Just don't talk anymore. Some people just go on and on and monologue so that others don't get a chance to weigh in. And I tell you what happens, folks. People resort to these tactics because they've learned that they work. A husband is found that when he's in an argument with his wife and she's not going along, if he'll just raise his voice, then she backs down. Or with his kids, when he didn't like something to happen with his kids, if he'll just get really rough in them, then they just kind of cower and back down and do whatever he wants. Some elders have learned that lesson. Get people in a meeting, they're giving him a hard time, they'll look across the table and say, look, buddy, we're the elders and this is how it is. And people bow to that and capitulate. They learn that it works. And so when they are afraid that something's about to happen that they believe is bad, they resort to violence. They use these tactics they've learned to eliminate anybody else from participating in the conversation. So if it works, and I get my way and I believe my way is right, why not do it? The answer is yeah, forget about buy-in. I'm sorry. Okay, so you're throwing scripture at me. And that's my first answer. We don't do this because it's biblically wrong to do these kinds of things. I jotted some passages down. Proverbs 15:1, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up anger. Hey, you really want to have fun? Get two guys in a room who've both learned that they can get their way using these bullying tactics. And we call that an exploding volcano, right? Now you may have rocks being thrown at people. Proverbs 15:18, people with quick tempers cause trouble, but those who control their tempers stop a quarrel. Proverbs 18:13, anyone who answers without listening is foolish and confused, and on and on and on we can go. These kinds of bullying tactics for disciples are unlawful. God doesn't want us to behave this way. That's what's wrong with it. But looking at the picture even more broadly, if I exclude other people's information, then I don't get the benefit of that information. I don't understand the problem better because I don't have their perspective. I'm not going to make better decisions. Just mark it down. The shallower the pool is, the less information you have, the more likely is you're going to make a bad decision. Think about the guy who wants to buy the boat. If all he's thinking about is how great that boat's going to look out on the lake and how much he's going to enjoy fishing, and he's not thinking about the spreadsheet, how's that going to work out for him? He needs that information. Folks, getting our way is not always the right thing. We need the input of other people. That is at the heart of dialogue. The belief that I need to hear from other people. I need them to weigh in. I need to listen to what they have to say. And by doing so, we wind up making better decisions into which everyone buys in. Listen, you may win some battles with these techniques, but you're losing the war. Dishonors Jesus. So, as we wade into crucial conversations and we're trying to get everybody to dump in their bucket, here are the two enemies that we deal with. Some people in those conversations, they're just going to drop out. They're going to go to silence. And the task is, how do I pull this guy back in? I need his information. He needs to be part of this. How do I pull him back in? Other people are going to resort to violence, and they're going to start raising their voices and interrupting and doing things like that. So how do we take a guy like that and get him to become a meaningful participant without driving everybody else away? So in tomorrow night's session, we'll spend some time thinking about that. I need to pause. It's about 5 till 8 and ask you what questions you would like to ask, or what feedback you would add to what we've said. Yes. Yes. So the question was, doesn't buy-in sometimes involve sacrifice? I think I know where you're going with that. I'm a little reluctant to use the word compromise because I think when we hear the word compromise, we say, well, we're giving up what we want. So I don't see that in Acts 15. I don't think anybody has given up what they want. I think as they add information, they develop a better picture of what everybody wants. You see what I'm saying? So I'm not going to eliminate compromise as a piece of this. But what I think dialogue accomplishes is it raises all of our understanding. And then as a result of that, we find a third option. And you're right in the sense that they're sacrificed and that I didn't get what I wanted at the very beginning. But maybe by the time we're done and we found our way around to this third option, we decide, you know, I think that one's even better. now that I've got all this additional information? That's a great question, though. And that becomes a difficult part of this, you know, when you're talking about compromise or when you're just developing a third idea. In the book, they call it the elusive and. Sometimes we think we only have two bad choices, when in reality, we've just not opened ourselves to the other options that are out there. Another part of it, Tim, that I had to cut out of the material. Sorry about that. What other questions can I answer for you? Okay, tomorrow.